Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Hindu Studies. This is your host, Dr. Raj Balkaram. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Jennifer B. Saunders on her very fascinating book, Imagining Religious Communities. Jennifer, how are you? Welcome to the program.
I'm great. Thank you for having me.
So what's your book about?
In a nutshell, I would say it's about a transnational Hindu family and their social networks and the ways that they tell stories to help create and maintain connections across international borders.
So let's talk about this idea of, for those of you who've seen the link online, you'll see the subtitle is Transnational Hindus and Their Narrative Performances. So what's a transnational Hindu?
I've done a lot of work with religion and immigration, and I've struggled with terms like immigrant, diaspora, transnational, and I've decided to use the term transnational when speaking about this group of this particular community, because this post 1965 American Hindu Indian immigrant community is much more defined by the ties that they've maintained across national borders rather than their dispersal. They've because of the level of education and their middle class status from the beginning, they were always able to, go back and forth between, and particularly the community that I've studied is settled in the United States. They've always been able to go back and forth between the United States and India instead of, earlier generations who were perhaps more cut off from family and community back home. So I prefer to talk about them as transnational because in essence, they're really living their lives across borders rather than, kind of in their own separate countries.
No, I like the concept both in terms of thinking about what we may otherwise call diaspora or Hinduism in diaspora. I also like the term because it has a lot of implications that are especially rich in our time, in our epoch, where we can, so much of what we do isn't necessarily tied to the soil we're on anymore. For example, I'm in Toronto right now and you're in Connecticut and we are in intimate conversation about your book and this sort of translocal phenomenon of our age is probably one piece of the transnational performance of Hinduism that you're talking about. How would diaspora be different from transnationalism, would you say?
What's that?
How would diaspora be different from the term that you're driving at?
Sure. So when I think about diaspora, I think of it as literally dispersed, communities are separated from this homeland that they yearn for, but don't really get to go back to. So I think about diaspora, you know, in the classical sense of the Jewish diaspora, you know, as that kind of epitome of what a diaspora is. Obviously, with the creation of the State of Israel, that is no longer the case, but this, you know, kind of yearning for this imagined homeland that is really more of a, you know, unattainable, but remains this kind of central part of their narrative. Whereas the India for transnational Hindus is real. It's still there. It's still experienced. It's still, visited and crossed over to many, you know, many times, over the course of the decades. So, I like to make that distinction. I know that, it's not necessarily the way that many people, do that, but for me, it's important to make that distinction.
Well, in terms of diaspora, I mean, we use it in religious studies, obviously, and it's tied, as you mentioned, traditionally to a people in exile, right? And so the idea of inhabiting a land other than your own, in the Hindu context, in our day and age, is far richer than a people in exile, right? And so, yeah. Obviously, as I was reading your book, what comes to mind is I visit this South Indian temple in Toronto, north of Toronto, in Richmond Hill, the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple. It's been there for 3 or 4 decades. And I have a fascinating relationship with the temple in that the culture is alien to me because my ancestors were North Indian, and my immediate ancestors were from Guyana.
Right.
Right. And when I go to the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple and I see children born in Canada participating in dance festivals or having their parents explain things to them or doing puja, I often muse that unless you look out the window, you don't really know that you're in Toronto when you're in the temple. And I think that's sort of what this concept is about. It's the experience of being a Hindu and engaging ritually and culturally isn't diminished based on the geographical location or something along those lines. Great.
Yeah.
So you focus on a specific story, specific family story. Tell us about the topic of the book or the focus of the book.
Well, the book really centers on the narrative of the Gupta family. And the Guptas are, you know, basically from the northwestern part of Uttar Pradesh and Haryana. They moved to the American Southeast in the early 1970s, so that early post-1965 wave, along with other students coming from India for many reasons, including opportunities for higher education. And there are a lot of reasons why the law changed in 1965. I know you read that's in my book, but in the United States, the law was signed in by President Johnson in 1965 that opened immigration up to different kinds of people than it had been opened up to before. And that really started this wave of immigration from South Asia in numbers that we hadn't seen before. And the Guptas were really part of that early post-1965 wave of people who came in. Dr. Gupta came to study engineering and ended up getting his PhD at North Carolina State. As he was doing that, he went back to India, married his wife. She came and joined him. And then they've lived in various places in the southern United States before settling in the Atlanta area. I want to say sometime in the late 80s. And his older brother, one of his older brothers had also come before him. They are also settled in Alabama. And the rest of his family is still back in India. And he comes from a large family. So there are lots of people all over Delhi. She also has a sister who lives in Delhi. And so I have spent time both with the Guptas in Atlanta, as well as their family members in Delhi. At the time I was doing my research, his family was still at the old family home in Chandni Chowk. And one of her older sisters had a home in South Delhi.
And so thank you for preempting the question about 1965. For those who may not be as familiar with that period, it's not dissimilar to maybe what was happening in the 1980s in Canada. So my family actually ended up, I actually immigrated to Canada in the early 80s when I was teenager-ish. And so, so along with this opportunity to immigrate in this movement, there's much more going on with this family. Tell us about Satya.
Oh gosh. Okay. So I first met him. I first heard about him before I even met him. The story about his birth was a story that was told in many different contexts, and I wanted to start the book with it because I thought he kind of epitomized this generation of transnational Hindus. His mother and father at the time that he was born were living in Nigeria. He is Mrs. Gupta, the Atlanta Mrs. Gupta's niece's son. The niece had married a man whose family was working in Nigeria, so he was living there. And when she married him, she moved there, but they did not want to have the baby in Nigeria because they said, at least in certain contexts, the story went that, you know, it just wasn't the hospital system wasn't good. They weren't comfortable with, you know, the medical system there. So they wanted to go have him somewhere where they felt more comfortable. And they decided on Atlanta. They didn't really give, you know, in many contexts, it was just, oh, well, they just decided to go to Atlanta for whatever reason, because the Mrs. Gupta and her husband lived there and she could come and help with the baby, and that was fine. So Satya was born in, I'm pretty sure there's a hospital in Atlanta on the north side of the city that's known for having a huge maternity ward. So he was born there. And the big story is that his father was somewhere off on the other side of the world doing business when she went into labor, because she went into labor early. And her uncle was on the phone with the dad for, you know, the entire time trying to get him back to, you know, get to Atlanta. But I guess the main point of the story is that Satya, whose parents lived in Nigeria at the time, was born in Atlanta. And then I think right after he was born in Atlanta, they stayed there for a while and then traveled to India to visit his grandparents who were still there. He didn't make it back to Nigeria until he was several months old. And because he was born in the U.S., he's a citizen of the U.S., and it turns out he's now in college, and he's in college in Chicago. And, you know, given the climate, you know, who could have predicted what things were going to be like at this point in our history? But, you know, given the climate, that we're in, he's pretty fortunate to have U.S. citizenship, because it might not have been so easy for him to get a student visa to come, you know, if he had been trying to apply for one at this point. So, you know, it's pretty fortunate that he was able to be born here.
So given that rich history of the places he's been tied to, tell us how he and his family have maintained or even reimagined their Hinduism. Like how have they managed to maintain practices across all of these political boundaries?
Right. So they had a little, I mean, as you know, Hinduism starts at home, and daily practice is something that you don't need a temple for that. You can just do that at home. And so the home practice is really the most important thing. So that was always there. But the Indian community in Nigeria wasn't very particularly big or vibrant, but his mother did. They did manage to connect them to some people there. They did, what was it, I can't remember. It was some kind of new religious, like early 20th century.
Arya Samaj?
What's that?
Arya Samaj?
It's not coming to me right now, but I can't remember.
That's all right.
Yeah. So she did, you know, bring him to some group gatherings, but you know, whenever they were visiting home, I don't know why. I guess I always thought of home for them as being with her parents, and they would visit for months at a time because his mother didn't work. So when he wasn't in school, they would go and stay with her parents for months at a time. That was where they would, you know, she would practice, he would learn whatever, you know, was going on at home. And then they ended up moving to Dubai. I don't know how many years ago. There's a larger, I'm pretty sure there's a much larger Indian community there. And I haven't kept in touch with them enough to know exactly what their religious practices are there. But, you know, I know that, you know, certainly they keep up doing things at home. Her mother was always very religious in terms of every morning doing her puja at home and being part of a number of different groups that would meet on a regular basis to recite different texts or sing bhajans and things like that. So, you know, I know that while Satya's mother was probably more, you know, as a mother of a younger child, probably wasn't doing these things as much as her own mother was, now that her kids were grown up, I'm sure she did what she could with young kids. And, you know, again, religious practice changes during different phases of life as well. So, you know, they would do the life cycle rituals for sure. But maybe she wasn't doing what her mother was doing to the extent that she was doing it, because she was busy raising two young kids and taking them around to various activities.
Great. So we have a good sense of what a transnational Hindu is in terms of the subtitle of your book, Narrative Performances. Tell us about the narrative performances, what that means or what you look at in your book.
Sure. So I've worked with performance studies a bit, and I look at the narratives that the community family members tell each other, both personal stories as well as religious stories. And I read the personal stories as religious because there are religious interpretations and religious contexts that help us understand these narratives because they do have religious implications. So I look at the ways that these stories are told and the context that they're told in so that I can understand the ways that they're creating meaning as they're being told. So many of the stories that I focus on are stories about immigration. That's a huge kind of story that comes up over and over again. It could come up in you know, kind of short bits, or it could be a longer narrative, but that comes up a lot in different contexts and has different meanings depending on the context it's told in. But I also look at stories that are religious stories that are told and performed, like the Sunderkund, which is the main religious story that the Guptas participate in telling over and over again.
So Sunderkund, maybe a quick note of reminder of what that is or where that's from.
Sure. So particularly this is from Tulsidas's version of the Ramayana, the Ramcharitmanas. The Sunderkund is the chapter, it's the shortest chapter, but it's the one that if anyone's going to recite just one chapter from the Ramcharitmanas, that's the chapter that people recite. They give all sorts of reasons why they do it, but basically they say it's the most beautiful, Sundar being beautiful, beautiful part. And they also say that within it, the whole story is told. And I could tell you more detail about what's in the actual Sunderkund if you want.
No, I think just so the audience can be reminded that it's a book of the Ramayana, the goings of Rama from in this case from medieval times as opposed to say Valmiki. Now, is this I haven't looked at Tulsidas's work. Is this, are there seven books there as well? I imagine so.
Yes.
And is it the fourth book?
Fifth. So
There's the Book of Childhood. There's Ayodhya. There's the Book of the Forest. I'll look it up.
I'm pretty sure it's the fifth. Here, I've got I have the ROM chart. I just happen to have a ROM chart monitor here.
Yeah, yeah. No one knows why it would be sitting on your desk.
In Hindi and everything. Let me see here. So Balkand, Ayodhikand, Aranyakand, Kishkindakand, and then Sunderkund.
Great. So so in terms of the narrative, it foregrounds the great devotee of Rama and Sita, Hanuman.
Right.
And so maybe say a note about that, because Hanuman has very different standing in different parts of Hindudom. Yes. And it seems that in North Indian culture, and particularly in transnational Hinduism, there seems to be a much greater propensity to venerate Hanuman or celebrate Hanuman in a sense than, for example, one might see in a South Indian temple. But nevertheless, tell us about this book and why this book is so integral to the narrative performance of these transnational Hindus.
Sure. So in the Sunderkund, it is the part where Hanuman leaps across the ocean. So right there, you've got crossing the ocean, just like the Guptas and their family have done. He leaps across the ocean from the southern tip of India to Lanka as in search of Sita, and he is the one who finally finds her imprisoned in Ravan's garden. And he performs all sorts of heroic acts while he is there. And it's funny because when people talk about the chapter, they focus mostly on Hanuman and what he does, but it's really only part half of what happens in the chapter, and half of it talks about the preparations for battle, because he goes back to Ram and relays to Ram what has happened in Lanka and that he has indeed found Sita and she is there. So he confirms, you know, he's the one who has found her because they've been searching for her since she's been abducted. And there's a lot of the chapter that actually talks about preparing for, you know, crossing the army crossing over and this bridge and you know, Ravan's advisors warning him against, you know, this folly of trying to fight against Ram, and, you know, his brother defects and goes over to Ram's side. And, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the chapter, but people really focus on this, you know, kind of Hanuman as the one who goes and finds Sita, and Hanuman as this great devotee of Ram. And of course, Philip Luckendorff's wonderful work, both on the Ramcharitmanas and on Hanuman, has talked a lot about how Hanuman has become this god that is revered by the middle classes, because he is this, you know, kind of middleman. He's approachable in a way that the great gods aren't. That he is, you know, he's the one who you can send messages through. He will listen and he will help his devotees be heard. So he's this very kind of approachable deity, whereas, you know, Ram and as the great god Vishnu is a little bit more remote. So he's really, his popularity has taken off. And in fact, the guru an ashram where the guru who started or who suggested to the Guptas to start this practice of reciting the Sundarkand, they have this huge Hanuman on their property in Haryana. And these large Hanumans have become this, you know, kind of common, will be commonly seen throughout North India. And again, my knowledge is with the North Indian community, so you might be right about South India. I have not seen Hanuman to the extent there. But yeah.
So these performances, what are they doing? Are they stage? Are they acting out the Sundarkanda?
No. They're sitting and reading and singing. So it's like a chant, but to a certain beat and tune. There often will be somebody playing a dholak, and just to keep a beat, and then everybody's singing along, some better than others. It's a lay, non-professional group of devotees who are just expressing their love and devotion to God, and it's a way for them to come together to practice together and really create a community around this practice.
So very much in the idiom of bhakti.
Yes. And many, so after they do the Sundarkand, they will often, different people will lead bhajans. It's not very formal. They do a little simple puja beforehand. There's a little bit of Sanskrit, but it's really minimal.
So this sort of narrative performance is in no real need of a priest, for example.
No. And this is, you know, pretty typical for these kind of neighborhood get-togethers, even the ones that I've seen in Delhi as well, where this is something that lay people are able to learn how to do and do for themselves without the need of a professional.
Great. So why is the first word in your title imagining? Why is it imagining religious communities? Tell us about that piece.
I was inspired by the imagination and the ways that Arjuna Padarai has discussed imagination and used the image, the imagination, and, you know, Benedict Anderson's imagining community to think about the ways that really, and it's not just limited to the Hindu communities that I've studied, but that we're all, you know, kind of working on creating our own communities and realities, and part of the process is these narratives that we tell. And it's not, you know, and I'm very clear that an imagined religious community is not one that doesn't exist, or that, I mean, it is real, and it is important, and it does function in an important way for people, but it's something that people help to create, I think, is what I want to emphasize, that it's something that isn't created for them and doesn't exist before them. It's created and recreated by doing, by practice, by telling stories, in the retelling over and over again, by coming together and by practicing rituals together, by telling stories, by sitting down afterwards and having tea and just discussing things, you know, whatever's going on in the community. That these, you know, these communities didn't exist when they moved here in the early 70s. They created them themselves. And so what I wanted to emphasize was that we talk about globalization as this kind of big force that's coming from above, that kind of pushes people in certain directions. And I wanted to talk about the force from below, that people, the power that people have themselves to help to create their own worlds, so that it's not just coming from outside, but that people have the power to create their communities as well. Yes, there were global forces at work that brought large groups of North Indians or large groups of Hindus and Indians to the United States at certain times. And, you know, yes, many of them were from middle-class families, and, you know, they fit certain demographic patterns. That was part of, you know, global forces kind of created that. But at the same time, the people who were part of that movement have their own power and agency in creating the communities that they ended up creating and are still working on. You know, they're never done. It's a process that's never finished. And I wanted to really emphasize this as a process, and imagining that, you know, kind of gerund. It's not imagined. It's imagining, and it's still being imagined. that's really why I made that choice.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So these transnational Hindus, in their imagining and reimagining continual their continual process of community creation, when you use the word imagining, it's obviously clear from the context that you're not talking about imaginary religion versus real religion or some such distinction. But who's doing the imagining, and what are they imagining, or what is this process? Because I think it's fascinating and rich. So I'm going to probe you a little bit. Like, is it like envisioning? Is it the founders of these communities? Is there some sort of imagined ideal that they're aspiring after? Is this, like, tell us a little bit more about what's being imagined or who's doing the imagining.
That's a good question. I mean, and I would probably say that, you know, at least for the purposes of this book, I'm probably part of that process as well. And I try to, you know, be as transparent as possible in terms of where I'm coming from, in terms of my perspective and how I'm interpreting what they're doing as well. But you know, if I'm just talking about what they're doing in the process, you know, it's a group effort, and it's negotiating, and it's messy. You know, there are people who have different ideas about what things should look like. And there, you know, I talk about different groups in the book, and you know, the Sundarkand group is only one group in this Atlanta community that is functioning, and there are other ones. One has actually stopped meeting because it was really intended to teach the second generation about Hinduism, and now the second generation of that first group is grown, so there's no need for them anymore. But that was run mostly by men in the community, and Sundarkand is, you know, the Mrs. Gupta is really kind of the lay leader of this group, and so it's different than this other group that was run by men. And then there's also this, you know, I speak about it in the book as well, this Mata Chalki, where the woman who kind of really is the glue for that group is much more charismatic. And there are different people acting in different ways, and the communities coalesce in different ways based on the different kinds of authority that they're perceiving and experiencing. And it's constantly negotiated. You know, I would say gender plays a huge role in terms of, you know, in many ways, women were kind of the ones to at least in the first generation really take on what Hinduism is and transmit it to that second generation. But there were always, you know, some men who wanted to take that on as well. And there are disagreements sometimes about, well, what does it mean, you know, that Sita was never accepted fully after she was, you know, imprisoned by Ravan. And they do discuss those things. So it's not a done deal. It's constantly something that's negotiated, and certain people have more power than others to influence, I would say, the way the community goes. But you know, there's always resistance, and there are always people who are questioning things.
So this idea of narrative performances, obviously you talked about the Sundarkand. You also mentioned in passing earlier that you see the life narratives, the personal stories, as also very religious. And the personal stories, really, they're a large part in weaving together this family and even your study on this family. So tell us what you mean when you say that their personal narratives are also religious.
I read them in terms of dharma and the ways that the kind of expectations that dharma places on sons and husbands and wives and daughters and mothers and fathers shape those narratives. So for example, you know, we have Dr. Gupta's story about how he made the decision, or in his case, didn't make a decision to come to the United States, just how it kind of happened to him. And if you, you know, I'm assuming if you read the book that, you know, he really kind of frames it as this thing that happened to him instead of a decision that he made, that he was definitely going to come and stay. And which is really telling in terms of, you know, how he frames that story. You know, and if you look at the, you know, his role at the time that he came was, you know, he was a student. And so, yes, his role was to learn and, you know, be obedient and do what he was supposed to do. And, you know, he was that, you know, good Indian son who was learning engineering and doing those things. But at the same time, it meant leaving his family behind in Delhi. And so it's always framed in terms of, you know, kind of balancing those competing demands, understanding that, you know, that dharma is, you know, that context in which the story is told and needs to be understood within that context. So the decision to, you know, then once he got his degree, settle and have, you know, and have a career in the United States instead of going back to Delhi where he had been offered a job, was again, like, and again, he also talks about it as if it wasn't his decision. It was just something that happened to him. You know, it's important to know that, yeah, he makes it seem as if he was just kind of pushed around by these forces instead of actively choosing to, you know, break away from his big extended family and settle in the United States to, you know, create his own family and take care of them and you know, make really, you know, make a life that was full of all these opportunities for his own kids. One of the reasons why I think he continues to tell the story the way he does is because, you know, in the back, he's leaving his family behind.
Oh, that's fascinating. So in your process of researching and writing this book, was there anything that really surprised you in terms of your findings of the process? Like what, I mean, we all have different sort of approaches to our research. Some of us have a sense of the answer and just need to go and find it in the data. Some of us sort of are very open-ended. But I think all of us learn something, perhaps even surprising through the process. So what was it about this book's findings that really surprised you?
And I think just being open to hearing them allowed me to understand how much they were responsible for shaping their own lives and experiences, or at least framing the meaning of their own lives and experiences. You know, if that makes sense.
This is similar then to what we just talked about in terms of the personal narratives being religiously framed. In terms of they frame their experiences with respect either to Dharma or pressures beyond their personal agency. So for example, Dr. Gupta, it's something along the lines of destiny or the pressures of karma. And this religious frame seems to be quite crucial to the imagining of the religious community that they're a part of.
I mean, I think I'm the one who's putting that on there and reading it within that context as the scholar. Like I find that that's my that I'm responsible for, you know, understanding that that's an important context for understanding the narratives that way. I think what I'm trying to say is that, you know, they really, you know, I'm thinking about this other woman, one of the nurses that I touch on in the book, and how she really took control of her own life, and you know, in a time when, you know, there weren't a lot of women who were able to do that, and you know, she didn't like the way she was being treated in India, even though she had, you know, had a good education. And so coming to the United States was a way for her to really take charge. And she, you know, I guess it's hard to see, when you look on that from the outside, it's often hard to see that, because what you see is you see, you know, kind of perhaps what might look like a typical Indian woman who's, you know, taking care of her family and doing the things that she's supposed to do, but you don't realize how much she's really kind of done to take control of her own destiny.
That's interesting. It's very interesting. So was there anything in the book that you hoped we would touch on that we didn't?
You know, I guess the one thing that I wanted to talk about was just ethnography in general.
That's so funny, because I almost always start off with methodology. So you're studying text, so you're studying people. So, and the one time I don't is the one time the interviewee is keen enough to circle back. Yeah, please tell us about your data. Like, tell us.
Well, no, I just wanted to talk about doing ethnography a little bit and my approach to it, because, you know, it's at least the way that South Asian religion has been taught, it's often very focused on text and classical texts. And so, you know, when you're talking about Ramayana and referencing Valmiki. Valmiki is a completely, like, it's not even in my world, which is fine. I mean, when I hear Ramayana, and when the people that I've worked with say Ramayana, they mean the Ramcharitmanas. Like, that, there's no doubt that that is what they are talking about. And I had the, you know, wonderful fortune to work with Joyce Flückiger, who's an amazing folklorist and ethnographer. She was my advisor at Emory. And I also had a wonderful opportunity to take a class when I was doing my master's that was actually called The Art of Ethnography, which I guess, you know, I've always taken that to heart, that it's not, you know, it's not a science, it's not, it is an art. And I guess, so my approach when I'm working, and I've always struggled with what to call the people that I've done my work with. I was in this Art of Ethnography course. The professor always wanted us to call them consultants, which I like, because they are the experts of their own lives. And it's just when I've used that term outside of, you know, with anybody else, they don't understand who I'm talking about. But I guess I just wanted to, you know, talk about the fact that, you know, the people that I've worked with, the people that I've studied, the people that, you know, I've done this ethnography with are the experts in their own lives. And I'm only there to kind of help put it together. And I hope that I've done that justice.
So imagine you're alluding to not wanting to call them, for example, subjects.
Yes.
Research subjects.
Correct.
Because it can very well, it can be, it certainly suggests a very different power dynamic when someone is your research subject as opposed to when someone's your consultant. What do you think of the word informant? I know that has a bit of a different connotation.
That's a good question.
Consultant's an interesting concept, but the idea that there's two tensions here that I perceive. There is the tension between, you know, what's happening on the ground in Hinduism versus what do we see in these ancient Sanskrit texts, you know, the little tradition, the great tradition, or popular Hinduism versus something more similar to what I do. And then there's the second one has just slipped my mind. I'm under the weather today. But there's also the tension of, oh yes, especially with, I think with world religion in general, but particularly in the case of South Asia or Indian religions, we have the tension between the mindset, the mentality, the categories, the theory with which we decide to approach the data. And far too often, folks end up in the pitfall of round holes and square pegs type
thing. Right.
And really it's some of the concepts, for example, that I come up with in looking at the texts I look at come from having looked at the texts for a long time or using words that are in the texts because it's this idea that the theory is ours with which we look at the data, it really doesn't work with South Asia. And I think the more successful among us sort of have to, the data ends up enriching the theory before we can even further process that. I don't know if you'd agree with that kind of, that we take our lead from the stories themselves that you're hearing, for example, then coming to the situation with the science of ethnography under your belt.
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I suppose if I had gone there and, you know, they were studying Sanskrit texts, I would have been at a loss. I don't know. that would have been a tough one for me. I suppose I would have, you know, studied Sanskrit more, I guess. I don't know.
The idea that the it resonated with you that the course is called The Art of Ethnography because it's not a rigid science. It has to be, I mean, I've joked probably about, you know, half a dozen times on this podcast that I love people. My main livelihood and skill sets relate to people and processing people and helping people grow, for example. Mm-hmm. I have no idea, you know, when I was growing up, socializing was in school. I didn't even begin to think I can get credit for actually engaging people in conversation and interviewing them, because that was just a way of being. Mm-hmm. I often joke that why on earth am I a textualist?
Right.
But it seems to me, and I don't have any formal training or experience, but it seems to me that conversations you have with your consultants, it's very much a collaboration, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
For
and
sure.
That's not quite the idea we come away with when you're researching a group of people, right? That it's mm-hmm. a collaboration, and that the conversation is fundamentally unpredictable. And sometimes we're not even asking the right questions. Sometimes we change the questions we're going to ask based on the responses we get partway through. Right.
Well, that's the beauty of being able to work with a community for a period of several years, because things change and you hear one thing and that makes you kind of take a different direction, or, you know, think about different things or think about things in a different way. It's, you know, it's fluid. And giving it time. I mean, I've worked with this community over many, many years, and giving it that time, I've been fortunate enough to have that much time with them, really allowed me to let things go where they were going to go, instead of kind of directing them myself. You know, certainly the conclusion that I came to at the end, you know, if I had written this book 10 years ago, it would have been different. And, you know, things have played out in a way that I probably wouldn't have predicted. So, you know, I don't know that I would have predicted that this other group, that had been, you know, kind of very central, to the Atlanta community would have died out. You know, I just wouldn't have expected that. But now I'm, you know, kind of seeing a little bit more clearly how the life cycle of these groups may work. And, you know, that these kind of Pakka South Indian temples really do have something there, because, you know, even the North Indian second or third generation are doing their rituals there. I wouldn't have predicted that.
So just as I thought we were wrapping up, but we'll pursue this line of thought, because it's too fascinating.
Sorry.
No. This is a good thing. This is, we're exemplifying the very same thing that I'm talking about, in that this is a conversation, and I can't have a scripted number of questions, because who knows where my consultant will take me.
Right. Well.
And so this idea about the life cycle of such groups, I mean, this is a fascinating insight. The idea that on the one hand, Hinduism is extraordinarily portable and starts off at home, you know, on your parents' knee type thing, or at your home shrine, you know, observing rituals and whatnot. And this other idea that these permanent structures of worship in the public sphere are needed to somehow maintain the life cycle, right? So tell us about what it is, this sort of tantalizing insight that you're alluding to, about what you've learned, or what you're learning about this need for temples, perhaps.
So the Gupta's daughter has two young daughters herself now, and she's a busy doctor. She's just, you know, kind of getting by and working hard, like, you know, most of us are. And so, you know, kind of as I was getting ready to finish the book, I, you know, we talked a little bit about where things were and how she, you know, how things were going and really what she was doing with her children, because I knew how she had learned about Hinduism through her parents and through her parents' community. And it that surprised me, because, you know, they're not doing these groups like her parents did, but they're going to there's a the Atlanta Hindu Temple, or Hindu Temple of Atlanta, in Riverdale, south of Atlanta, is a big you know, one of those like temples based on the Tirupati. And, you know, it's been there for a couple of decades and very, you know, they built it the right way. And, you know, but so when they had their, you know, daughter's, you know, mundan or what, you know, anything, or when they bought a new house or, you know, any very kind of big event that they wanted to have a puja for, they went there. They didn't go to the more North Indian style temples that, you know, aren't really, you know, built according to the right, you know, according to the way that they're supposed to be built. They're going to these South Indian temples because they are proper temples and they don't understand how the priests are doing the ritual, because it's not, you know, the way that they do them in North India, but because they have proper priests and, you know, they just have it done there. And that surprised me. It really surprised me.
We've come full circle, because this is precisely what you'll see at the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple. Mm-hmm. I believe it was built in the early 80s. In Richmond Hill, which is a city just north of Toronto. So sort of at the time in the middle of nowhere. And it's, as you say, it's pukka, you know, which isn't a South Indian word, but we get the idea, the listeners get the idea, that sort of means it's fully cooked. Yes. It's the real deal. It's the way I explain the energy of that word is it's not half-baked.
Yes, right, exactly.
And so the temple is has an enormous following. It's a huge temple. Traditionally trained priests come from India, and they maintain the temple day in and day out, 365 days a year, and that's been the case for decades. And so there are Hindus who aren't part of that community, and that they may not be Tamil speaking, or they may not, they may be much closer to myself, although I'm probably much further outside of the sphere, much further to the periphery of even those Hindus. But folks who don't dress that way, don't speak that way, don't eat those foods, don't understand half of the festivals that are very uniquely mm-hmm. South Indian, and yet they will go and they will sponsor a fire ritual, or they will go and have their new car blessed,
right?
And they'll go there. Not because of a community tie, not because they can really sort of, they're outsiders in the immediate sociocultural dimension, but there is this notion that the spiritual religious dimension is pristine enough to warrant going there to procure the blessing they're looking for. So it is fascinating, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. And, you know, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, it's not about community at all for them. It's not.
Exactly. Exactly. And
it's more just a transactional, like, we're just going to get this blessed and, you know, we're going to do it properly and we've done what we're supposed to do.
Exactly. And this exchange is uncanny, because I had a colleague and friend come out from out west, where I did my doctorate. I did my BA and master's in Toronto. And then I went to Calgary to do the PhD. And so someone I've known out there since maybe, I don't know, 2012 or so. She happened to be in Toronto this weekend. It dawned on her that she wanted to get a Ganesh Murti. She's a Western woman from Alberta. And so she really wanted a Ganesh Murti, but she didn't just want art. She wanted it blessed, right? She wanted to get it blessed, you know? So I thought to myself, I'm like, would you be interested in going into the Richmond Hill Hindu Temple? It's a beautiful space that you probably want to see anyhow. And she's like, yeah. So this is exactly what transpired this past weekend, a transaction to obtain a blessing or to activate the Murti, you know, the Prana Pratishtha, right?
Yeah.
To have the deity's energy reside within, you know, her embodiment at home. And it's fascinating. And she emailed reflecting on the experience. And in the email, I said, look, the temple functions on a number of levels. The first one that I listed was the sociocultural dimension. I says, I am fairly alien to that dimension because I was born in Guyana. My ancestors were from North India. And I don't even know what the exact articles of clothing are called or the styles. There's so much there that I just don't know. And I'm a tourist there in that dimension.
Right.
And yet having the training in the Sanskrit and some ritual, I'm very much at home in the ritual dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think that ritual dimension is what folks are after, because the idea is that in the ritual comes the blessing, through the ritual comes the blessing.
Right.
And there's all kinds of fascinating questions, because the question of, well, you know, it's all good and well to not need a Hindu priest when you are chanting to Hanuman, and that's perfectly valid and probably transformative.
Mm-hmm.
But we need a Hindu priest if we're going to bless our car.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. But I think we've sort of stumbled upon a new subsequent project for one of us or probably someone else. Which brings me to my final question. You know, what are you working on these days? And if you want to tell us a little bit of your context, and you know, you do other work, but the question is like, what if anything are you working on in terms of further research?
If I had time.
tell us a bit about that. I think the audience might be fascinated, because you and I are in unconventional situations as scholars, yet I think unconventional is now conventional for our field.
Yeah, given the way academia has been going. So this is based on my PhD dissertation, the book. So it's been a long time coming. I'm grateful that I was given the time and was able to finally get it done. I did start a second research project after I did the initial research for this book, which was funded by a senior fellowship, short-term fellowship by AWIS. So I have to give them a shout out and thank them for that.
Translation, AWIS, I know exactly
American
what you mean.
Institute
of Indian Studies. They have all kinds of research programs. For example, they have an amazing language training program in various cities. I did my Sanskrit training in 2012 at Pune through AWIS. So yes, shout out AWIS.
Yes.
Please proceed.
Thank you. So I did, this was back in 2009, so it's now 11 years ago, but I did start a project where I was looking at women's bhajan groups in Delhi. I was looking at the ways that women transmit bhajans, and I was interested in, let's say, I guess my assumption was that bhajans would have normally been transmitted from one generation of women to the next generation of women in joint households, joint family households. And that, you know, in kind of these modern contemporary urban settings, that things might have changed a bit. And I wanted to look at modern urban satsangs in different kind of contexts, mostly middle to upper middle class contexts. So I did some work with some of these groups, and I've done a little bit of, I've done a couple of presentations on it, but I haven't written anything yet. But that's, you know, kind of one of the lines of thought. While I was doing that research, I also came across this religious text called the Amrit Vani, which, you know, I found out about on as I was traveling to Delhi to start this research. I'd never heard of it before, and the woman who was sitting next to me had been listening to it, and we ended up exchanging information. She ended up actually being a consultant and living very close to where I was living. So she's been a great resource for me. But and then I ended up finding Amrit Vani everywhere since then. So I'm kind of fascinated by this and want to know more about where this came from and how this phenomenon has spread. Because it's one of these, it's a very simple, very, very simple text that people, you know, kind of recite in groups. You don't need a priest or specialist for it, but it just seems to be really, really popular.
So then you'll have to come back when your Amrit Vani book is out.
Yeah. If I ever have time to write it, sure.
Sure. Now, Jennifer, so busy with her job that we have to wait a good month or so until it was a holiday.
Yes.
To get on a call, which is fine, which is fine. You know, there's no shortage of things to do. But you never know. You never know what opportunities may open up in terms of being able to pursue that research. But in either case, you're obviously very welcome back when next you have some research you'd like to share with the world.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. It was great chatting about your book. And so for everyone listening, we've been talking to Jennifer B. Saunders. She's an independent scholar based in Stanford, Connecticut. We've been talking about her book, Imagining Religious Communities, Transnational Hindus, and Their Narrative Performances. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Until next time, keep reading. Bye-bye.